Hello, this is Andreas Weigand. I'm here with Dan Ariely. Hello, hello. How are you?
And I'm here with Elena Love.
Hello.
Hello.
Isn't this an amazing name, Elena Love?
It's
wouldn't you want that?
It wouldn't go with him very well.
Wouldn't go with your personality.
No.
I think it would.
All right, so Elena just asked a few good questions. And that's when I, pulled out my little recorder out of the pocket and said, let's actually, grab that here. So let me turn it back to you.
Okay, so one of the questions I asked you earlier is if the focus of your work was to utilize data inside the organization to help them in turn apply it to network marketing through their customers.
And to that I replied that it is not just about the data that already resides within the organization. And it's not just going out and trying to sniffing more of the digital exhaust, which you can get from clients or customers or users or however you want to refer to individuals. But it's about creating incentives so people will actually share stuff with you and potentially also share stuff about their friends with you. That helps you actually get further upstream, as I usually say, in their decision making. If you reflect upon it, a large percentage, I think, of our dollar spent is spent based on what our friends tell us, spent on what the people who we trust tell us. And for that, we want to have some channel how people can express that. Dan, what do you?
I think it's reasonable. I think if you think about the relationship between patients and physicians, nobody ever says to their physician, I don't want to tell you something. It's private information. People have an incentive to share because it's good for them and they clearly see the value. The challenge for other things is how to express the value such that people think or know that it's actually in their benefit to share this information. Companies can do great things for people. They can also do awful things for people, but they can also do great things for people with data. The question is, how do you create the contract such that people are interested in doing it and benefit from it as well?
I'm wondering, did you see recently, I think it was this week's Business Week, has an article about patient social networking websites that have been established to examine how I can get access to treatment for my diabetes or how I can get access to treatment for my rheumatoid arthritis. And patients are sharing with one another what they've learned through their own research. And it would seem to me they've established that exact thing you're looking for, that sense of trust and connectedness with one another that has them sharing their deepest information with total strangers.
So one of the interesting things actually is we share amazing details, amazing secrets with Google, which we wouldn't share with any person. What makes people do that? And I think the answer is they get within a couple of seconds something back which bears some relevance and helps them. Google is very poor in terms of having a dialogue with the user. I think there should be much more of a dialogical structure there, but which helps them refine their query in order to hopefully get a little bit closer to their secret desires answers. But the relationship to a search engine is not, when I talk about the transition from transaction economics to relationship economics, is not what I have in mind. Transaction means you just know the outcome of the decision process. I buy my ticket in United Airlines, and they have no idea what made me actually do that, whether it was just out of the whim or whether it was 3 hours of deliberated research which preceded it. If you have access to all of the interactions that lead to it, much better situation already. Amazon's, people bought X, also bought Y, is transaction. People looked at X and eventually bought Y is a beautiful example of interaction. Much more powerful. But if you allow people, wish lists being an early example, to share their intent, I think the, going back to your question, the implication is much larger than just network marketing. One thing I learned from Dan is people know exactly what they want. And the other thing I learned from him was we also know exactly what state the world is in. And the third thing I learned from is that the world is a deterministic place. We know exactly how it's developing.
That's right.
I think I got those things
absolutely. So as people have no clue mostly what they want or where the things stand, there's a question of how do they build these consideration sets? How do we think about what is in and out our consideration? And it's so useful to understand what was in other people's consideration sets, not just what other people ended up doing. The reason that some of those user groups that talk about different problems, and I think the first ones used to be on AIDS, when there was a huge group discussing AIDS, was so successful is because they tried all kind of home remedies. And they tried tea and mushrooms and pot, and they would report on it. And they didn't only report on what was successful and what they end up doing. They also reported what didn't work out for them and what version didn't work out for them. And that was incredibly useful. Mm-hmm. If you only have what ended up working, what you ended up buying, and even not if it worked for you or not at the end, it wouldn't be as successful. So you really want to capture much more of that depth of information.
There is a simple example that the average consumer, especially anybody who cooks, is aware of. There's something called Cooks Illustrated, and they have what's called America's Test Kitchen, and they create a cookbook, a Cooks Illustrated cookbook. And in that cookbook, they describe all of the things that they tried to do to prepare a certain recipe that they're now giving you, and what failed and why that failed, and why they chose the things they chose, and why they recommend the type of pasta they recommend, or the how long you cook it, or what you add to it,
and
when.
That's fantastic.
So
the Illustrated Cookbook.
Cooks Illustrated.
Cooks Illustrated. Okay, mm-hmm. I need to get that one.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing I learned from Dan is that some people, you know, most people don't know probabilities, but I didn't know to have Dan to teach me that. So let me actually run it by the way I now tell that story.
Okay.
So there are good things in life and there are bad things in life, okay? And there are things like expected things and things like unexpected things. So that gives us a 2x2 matrix.
Like everything in life, it's all 2x2 matrices.
Exactly. And as everybody, always the top right is where you want to be.
Yeah.
So just to be clear what these 2x2, what these four cells are. So if you will, top left is good expected things like benefits. On the right, if you will, at the bottom is costs. And what we know from Danny Kahneman is that on average, the weight people put on the cost is twice as big on the weight. So people, you know, value a dollar gained half as much as it hurts them if they lose a dollar. So that's overall population. Now, what's new, I think, and what people probably will, once big accidents happen, start considering more, is what are the extreme values. So they say 0.1 percentile, 0.01 percentile, which is that, you know, something can go really wrong. So it could be that, you know, you post something on Craigslist, somebody shows up and robs your house. Or what could be really doing really well. For instance, you post your profile and you say you are single and next day somebody shows up and you marry them. So those are the four cells here. I personally think that people, often actually situation depending, have very different interpersonal differences in how they value those cells. For instance, in the startup world, you know, people don't worry about the benefits. People worry about winning the lottery, the top right cell.
Yeah.
Whereas...
By the way, the same thing also happened with some cancer treatments, that people don't think about it as if buying a lottery. It's a very small probability of prolonging life, and usually people just suffer, with some of them much more, but they really focus on the small probability of a good event.
So what does that 2x2 matrix remind you of?
What does it remind me of?
Is there standard, I mean, you know all these things, I don't know, utility, you know, all these frameworks. So this explicitly calling out, if you think about interaction design, many people when they, you know, send a message to somebody or poke them or whatever they do these days, they don't take into account that there is a cost of the recipient, an attention cost he has to pay or she has to pay. And my reaction on Twitter is if somebody, you know, sends me too much stuff I'm not interested in, I stop following them.
Right.
That is the sort of regular case. On the other hand, if you go for the extreme values, your behavior would be very different. You would suffer through, you know, all these random messages which are totally uninteresting to maybe pick that gemstone, that, you know, great insight somebody has. Standard behavior economics decision-making frameworks, what do they have in terms of differentiating between expected values and extreme values?
Not really, because it's all supposed to be just integrated under a single function that has all of the distribution of all the properties. But the interesting thing is that if you, and I'm not sure there's evidence for this, but I think the thought is that when you talk about small probabilities, that's where optimism and pessimism could
enter in,
where I think particularly in romantic relationship, people are hopelessly optimistic and they take very small chances and nevertheless pursue things to a great extent. I mean, online dating is an example. Most people get very little out of it, but spend so much time, it's unbelievable. But they're still hopeful and hopeful and hopeful.
And I think they're hopeful because they get something after, you know, clicking on a button, which supports some profile. They get more ideas of what they could be doing about the person. And the less information there is, the more likely they are to actually, because their fantasies doesn't get destroyed.
That's right. You know this paper we have? We have a paper showing that the less people know about somebody else, the more they like them. And the idea is that if I tell you I like music, you think I like the kind of music that you like. So originally people create some similarity between them and the person, but as they learn more and more about that person, they get more and more disenchanted with them.
Which supports the old adage, familiarity breeds contempt.
That's right. That's right. And by the way, there's an interesting analogy here to think about Obama. If you think about it, in the primaries, he started as being much more successful than he ended up during the primaries. And I think part of it was that I'm very happy, you know, he's elected and so on, but as we learn more and more about him, he could not be everything to everybody anymore.
True.
And as he goes into the White House and starts having to decide about some policies, he will be able to be even less and less so everything to everybody. And then that's my worry, is that that's where disenchantment will come.
I always say that faculty gets hired on mu plus 2 sigma. And in some way, the less you know about somebody...
Maybe three sigma. No, but
so,
that's right. So that's why young faculty get so much precedence, because they have so much upside. And as people are known better, that it's clear that they're... And it's incredible, if you think about it, that the imagination of people is above reality. Like you have a new rookie that you think about hiring as a faculty, and you say, what are the odds that they will be 2 standard deviation above the mean? And it's crazy. By the way, kind of as an analogy, the same thing I think happens with sexual attraction. We did a study once when we got pictures of women to be progressively more naked. And we asked people how attractive they find these women. And the most attractive women were not the fully naked women. Now, these were professional models, you know, they were very beautiful women with presumably perfect bodies, but somehow the imagination was even better than that particular reality.
Women have known that for years, Dan.
What?
Women have known that for years.
No, I think so. It's just men need some more time and evidence to figure this out.
You need a study.
But that's the lingerie industry, right? That's exactly what
absolutely.
They do.
Absolutely, absolutely. But don't you think, as we're discussing this notion of the decisions we make and the things we choose, that by and large, many of us make some of the most important decisions from a negative perspective rather than a positive? We choose what we choose because it doesn't represent what we have learned we don't want, rather than choosing what we choose from the perspective of being very clear about what we do want and pursuing identifying that.
I think in this generality, I wouldn't sort of subscribe to it. What I, however, do think is that different people put different weights on expected values, on risks, and on winning the lottery.
Yeah.
And what the web allows us is by people sharing their specific not beliefs and intents, but there's specific, you know, weights in those cells.
Let's take this point. So what do you believe that there will be more agreement about? Beauty or ugliness? So let's say we take people and
ugliness.
We categorize them as... I think so. So in some sense, I think that it might be easier to agree about negatives than about positive, right? We can find... We can vary on who we find attractive or what we find positive. We would probably agree much more about... It's a speculation. About the awful thing. And if that's the case... That means that at least it's easier to learn socially what are the negative things we should reject.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, Dan, you told me a year ago was one death is a tragedy.
Yeah.
A million is statistics.
Yeah, that Stalin actually said it originally, but yeah.
So I think what people consider as ugly, maybe what people consider as a tragedy, also really depends on how you're presented, how
you
present it.
That's right. But beyond that, so it's true that people would disagree, but beyond that, there's a question of what there will be more agreement about, ugliness or beauty, tragedies or good things?
Well, think about it. What are the things you remember most? Most of us remember the bad things that people have said to us or about us and take those to heart more readily than we recollect all the good things that may have been said. We tend to discount those.
I have an internet stalker who used to come on my site and write awful things about me and Danica Hanman. She would write about, you know, I don't want to say, but she would write about Danny's sexual habits, and she would write about me, how I got injured trying to kill little Palestinian babies, and it just a woman that was clearly making up stuff and just trying to make things happen. She used to be a student of Danny's, I think, and she, I think, became psychotic at some point. But the interesting thing was that now she posts some things on this, the some of the mailing list that we both belong to, and it's very tempting. I see it from her. Do I watch it or not? It's like having a tooth that is hurting, right? Do you push it a little bit to see how much it hurts?
Yes.
And if I do, and Danny said he does an automatic filter to eliminate it.
Yes.
And I do the same thing, but from time to time her emails escape the filter. And then I have a chance to look at it or to ignore it. And about half the time I look at it. And then I get upset, and I know everything there is to know. I know she's sick, I know that none of it is true, but nevertheless, it's very, very difficult. At least I don't answer her anymore. I used to try to do that.
You were going
to
fix it, right?
First you answered her, then you wrote that note for an hour, and then you deleted it before sending it. And now finally, actually, you don't actually write the note anymore.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so that concludes our
session.
18-minute conversation
on
the consumer data revolution or the personal data revolution, and ended up with how Dan reads his email. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.